the woman in the house across the street from the girl in the window, I hope I got that right, and the most recent, Dexter Original Sin. And by now, the agents listening are saying, Who is this guy? Why aren't we repping him? And the answer, of course, is my very talented and wildly successful friend, Mr. Michael Lehman. Michael, welcome to the soundtrack.
Happy to be here.
We're happy to have you. And, some listeners may be wondering about the music we're hearing right now, which is Johann Strauss's The Blue Danube. But a lot of folks, especially in Los Angeles, will have already figured out that, at least in the context of this show, we're going to talk about Stanley Kubrick's seminal film, 2001, A Space Odyssey. Michael, what is the significance of Mr. Kubrick's work to you?
Well, when I came up as a director, and before that, when I was a teenager and even a small child, I kept running across these incredible Kubrick films.
Yeah.
And he was a huge influence for me. I remember when I was learning to read that in the newspaper I saw the ads for movies and I could not decipher Dr. Strangelov or whatever it was. And then in 1968, when I was traveling, my parents took me and my sisters to see 2001 in a theater in London, in its first release. And it was a mind-blowing experience. So,
did you actually see Dr. Strangelov as a child?
I think I saw Dr. Strangelov after I saw 2001.
Okay.
But I did see it as a teenager over and over again. It was probably my favorite film.
So why Stanley Kubrick? What is it about his filmmaking that appeals to you particularly?
Mostly the dry sense of humor, the sardonic, ironic kind of humor, the satire, the great visual quality of his filmmaking, which is very evident in 2001, and his use of music, which is laden with irony.
And the irony and dryness of which you speak, I certainly see in a lot of your work, sir. And we're going to talk about that more. Now, tell us a little bit about how you got started. You made, I believe, a provocatively titled short film in film school that landed you some attention.
Yes, it was called The Beaver Gets a Boner.
Oh, my.
Yeah, and it was a silly kind of John Waters-esque satirical parody of a student film in many respects. And it was kind of funny. It had some oddball elements to it, and it screened along with the other USC films, which were very earnest. And because the others were so earnest and mine was so kind of iconoclastic and obnoxious, it got me some attention.
Although I can see a very earnest, straightforward, dramatic version of The Beaver Gets a Boner could have its own charms.
It could. Yeah. It could. Maybe at the end of my career, that's what I should be doing.
Go back to it. Yeah. So, and tell us a little bit about your breakout film, Heathers. How did that come to you?
It came to me through my friend Larry Karaszewski and his friend, the writer Daniel Waters. Dan was somebody I knew through Larry. And he was trying to get an agent for his film, for his script, which was a brilliant script. As we all know, Heathers was quite the script. He had a 200-page version of it, and he sent it to me and said, "You have an agent." I got an agent based on The Beaver Gets a Boner.
Wow. Good for you.
And he said, "Can you see if your agent will represent me?" And in fact, she flipped for the script. She agreed to represent him. And he asked that she take it to Stanley Kubrick. Seriously. And she did.
Wow.
And Kubrick was busy doing other things.
Yeah.
And I said to her, her name was Bobby Thompson, at the William Morris Agency. And I said, "Bobby, when Stanley passes, can we see if I can set this up?" And I had a deal at New World Pictures, which was no longer Roger Corman's New World Pictures. It was the next iteration of New World.
Okay.
And they took it on, and we got it made.
How interesting. All right. Well, I want to play a couple pieces next. The first is a track that served in a way as inspiration for the music in Heathers. And after that, we're going to hear a piece from the film as scored by David Newman. But tell us a little bit about how you conceived the music for the film. And I guess in a larger, more general sense, how does a director craft the sound of a film?
Well, I'm sure you've heard about, and Lev, you certainly know about, doing temp music for your film. While you edit, you take pieces of music and you cut them in against the picture.
Right.
And you do that for score, which you pick pieces of score that exist in the world and you try them against your picture, and you take songs and you play them that way.
And we should explain, you know, the use of temp music. You don't have the finished music yet. The composer has not started working on it yet. But you want to have music in to support your director's cut. So when the producers look at it, they're not looking at a dry cut.
Right. Watching a movie without music music is a tremendously difficult thing to do. And even people who claim to be knowledgeable about the filmmaking process cannot really watch a movie without music.
Yeah, it's amazing what a difference it makes.
Yeah, it makes a huge difference. Now, composers can, but by putting together a temp track, things that you don't have the rights to, things that you know you'll never use, things that have been composed for other movies, that sort of thing, you are at least indicating what you would like, what direction you'd like to go in with the actual music for the film, and you're making the process of watching the movie significantly better.
So you're both making it watchable, and you're setting a template that the composer may or may not follow, depending on your relationship with the composer.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay, cool. Well, here, I'm going to play a track that came out about a year and a half before Heathers was released. Well, wait a second. You didn't tell us. Tell us specifically about the music that you went for in Heathers.
Well, so we were looking for music that would capture the sense of high school in the 80s, but was not high school pop music. We didn't want to go in that direction.
Okay.
And mostly I was looking for, because Heathers doesn't really have songs, it doesn't have a song soundtrack. I was looking for something that would capture the mood of the film. And we happened upon The Art of Noise, which was an 80s electronic British band, a woman named Ann Dudley, who had composed music for movies already. They had conveniently made music that worked pretty well as temp track, and almost all movies made in the late 80s used Art of Noise while they were cutting. Yeah. It was standard issue.
I mean, there was a kind of an ambience quality to it.
Yeah. It was. It had sort of progressed from the electronic Tangerine Dream style that had been used in Risky Business, that had been used in Michael Mann movies, and it had. It was a little more playful, and it was a little more poppy.
Okay, cool. Well, so here's a track that came out about a year and a half before the film Heathers was released, so this may have very well been an inspirational touchstone for you. This band is covering a Prince song, and Tom Jones provides the vocals. This is Kiss by Art of Noise.
You don't have to be beautiful to turn me on. I just need your body, baby, from dusk till dawn. You don't need experience to turn me out. You just leave it all up to me. I'll show you what it's all about. You don't have to be rich to be my girl. You don't have to be cool to rule my world. Ain't no particular sign I'm more compatible with. I just talk dirty, baby, if you wanna impress me. You can't be too flirty, mama. I know how to undress me. Let me be your fantasy, and maybe you could be mine. You just leave it all up to me. We can have a good time. You don't have to be rich to be my girl. You don't have to be cool to rule my world. Ain't no particular sign I'm more compatible with. I just want your extra time and your kiss. Think I better dance now. Size, maybe we could do the twirl. You
Okay, so that was Kiss by the Art of Noise featuring Tom Jones from the Heather's Temp track that Michael Lehman, my guest today, used as part of his temp track score for the film. Now let's take a listen to a short track from the film itself. And your composer was?
David Newman.
David Newman. And he was doing mostly orchestral score before this film, right?
Yes, he was. And he's famous for his orchestral scores, which are terrific.
Yeah, they are amazing. Okay, so well, this is a quick track. It's about 60 seconds. This is from the Heather soundtrack. It's called Martha Dumbstruck. I have to correct myself. It's actually called Martha Dump Truck. Apparently, I was dumbstruck by the music. But Martha Dump Truck by David Newman. Very cool. So you really hear how Newman kind of took your temp track and ran with it.
Yes. I think, you know, we went to David because he was a great composer. And I wanted a real movie composer to do the
soundtrack. A real movie composer,
yeah,
yes.
You know, I wanted somebody
not
who knew
Uncle
what they
Bob
were doing.
On banjo, yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
And He loved the rough cut of the movie, and he saw the rough cut with the Art of Noise, a lot of Art of Noise, not entirely, but used in the temp tracks. And so I said to him, I said, I know you're famous and you're known for your beautiful orchestral scores.
Yeah.
But is there a way to kind of combine the two elements a bit?
Was he willing to go along with that, or did it take a little arm twisting?
No, he was very willing.
Cool.
I think he felt that this was an opportunity to do something a little different than what he'd
sure.
been doing. So, and he had done, like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure,
right.
If I remember correctly.
Very cool.
I could be wrong about that. Oh, my God. In any case, we didn't have the money to do an orchestral score.
Right.
It's very expensive. You have to hire an orchestra. You have to find a place, and then you have to pay them all sorts of money for residuals.
Darn musicians.
Yeah, they want to get paid for their work.
Yeah.
Outrageous.
Outrageous.
So David used some classical elements, some acoustic instruments, and he combined them with the synthesizer stuff that came really from the Art of Noise.
Very cool.
Feel. Yeah.
Very cool. Now, you and I have talked about the use of music in film before, and you said one thing to me that was very striking, I think maybe over martinis at some point, but you said to me that you thought the use of existing songs, or at least famous songs, felt like a kind of a cheat to you. Can you explain that to our listeners?
Yeah, it's ridiculous, but I always feel like if what you're responding to on screen is something that somebody else has already done,
uh-huh.
somebody else has done in the culture, and it's just pop music, I felt like this is – I don't quite feel that way anymore.
Okay,
but
so this was earlier.
Point, yes, yeah. I felt like, no, you are cheapening your movie by putting pop music in it, and – You're playing off of all the emotional resonance that pop music has for the viewers.
The person's memories.
Yeah.
Engaging.
And I thought that was a cheat because you were creating an emotional response from the viewer by using somebody else's work.
Well, I remember when you told me that, I was like, well, wait a second. I'm a huge fan of manipulating people's emotions. I view that as part of the job. And how is using popular tracks different than manipulating emotion with lighting or editing or color or sound effects? That's kind of our job in a way.
You're absolutely right.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
However, my feeling is, well, but if you can create the same emotions, if you can create this experience for the viewer using only the elements that you've provided for them,
right.
that there's a purity to it.
Okay.
That you're not relying on something. And I'm going to add one other element to this, which is that we associate with pop music to specific times in our lives and
right.
specific events and that sort of thing. So even though a famous pop song might resonate for everybody,
right.
it does resonate a little differently for everybody.
Yes, and it's not going to age well over time necessarily, especially
correct.
Like the 80s kind of sound that we just heard. Yeah.
It'll be dated.
Well, that's a very good point. I agree with you on that one. Now, one film that you brought up in particular, as an exception to this idea of, you know, cheating with these shortcuts, was the film Easy Rider. That came out in 1969, gave a young man named Jack Nicholson his breakout role, and became a countercultural landmark of the late 1960s, as you well know. So what was it about the music that was meaningful for you?
Well, I was a 12-year-old in 1969 with hair down well past my shoulders and thought I was a kind of a young hippie.
Uh-huh.
And I remember going to see the movie in a theater, and I was very excited to see it. And back then, all you could ever see in advance of any movie was a trailer. If you were lucky, you'd see it in the theater. So I went in, and it opens, I think, with Pusher Man by Steppenwolf, but then goes right into, as the movie kicks into gear,
right,
it's Born to be Wild, right, by Steppenwolf.
We're on the motorcycles.
Yes. And then the entire soundtrack to me, this goes counter to what I said a few minutes ago to you.
Yeah.
This soundtrack is so resonant of the period and the 60s and the countercultural attitudes. And it rocks. It just pushes the movie along.
So. Well, that reminds me of one of my favorite director jokes, Michael, which is, how many directors does it take to screw in a light bulb? And the answer is two. No, three. No, two. And on that note, okay, so as you mentioned, we were still kids when this movie came out, but we grew up heavily steeped in the themes of this film, freedom, disillusionment, the American dream. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Steppenwolf, Born to be Wild. Folks, you're listening to The Soundtrack here on the SoCal Sound, and we're here with director nonpareil, Michael Lehman. Michael, You mentioned another set of filmmakers that you said you really respected in their use of music. And they're also some of my favorites. We're talking about Joel and Ethan Coen. So specifically, you mentioned their film, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? What is it for you about the music in the film and how they employ it? Is it that it helps push the narrative or lends emotional shading or something else entirely?
Well, it does help push the narrative and it does provide emotional shading, but it also provides a sense of the period. And, you know, music frequently in movies and television does help create a sense of time. Mm-hmm. But in this case, they drew heavily on roots American music, and they had T-Bone Burnett compose the music. He put together the soundtrack. And I remember seeing that movie when it first came out, and I was a big fan of T-Bone Burnett's and a big fan of the Coen brothers. And I loved the way the music drove that story along. And there's that wonderful scene in the radio station where they sing a song, and it just brings up folk and blues and the kind of music that's not typically done in a pop soundtrack for a movie.
Sure.
And it incorporates the music really beautifully into the narrative.
Wow. Well, those are all great reasons. So we're going to listen to one of the tracks from that film. This is by the Soggy Bottom Boys. Great name for a band. Co-written with Dan Timmons, I think he says his name. This is I Am a Man of Constant Sorrow.
In constant sorrow.
Michael, what does a director do? I get asked this a lot. How do you define the job?
I get asked this a lot, too, and there's a very it's very difficult to define. You know, Don Siegel, the director, said if you can walk across a room and say action and cut, you're a director.
Okay.
So in the simplest sense, you're the guy on the set who runs things. But in actual fact, your job in the most general sense is to take a script and realize it with real people and real elements and bring it alive primarily visually for a camera.
So you're taking words on a page from a script and you're telling that same story with moving pictures, with pictures that move. Okay. But now that's okay, so that's a very simplistic definition, but people are saying, okay, but what does a director do? What are you doing? Do you show up on, do you yell at people? Do you point a lot? You know, what do you spend your day doing?
Well, before you get to the set, you design how you're going to shoot things. Okay. So you have a shooting plan and you have a visual sense of how the images can be, how you'll shoot them and how they'll fit together.
So you're not just showing up and making it up as you go along.
No. Okay. And then with the actors, you're also making sure that all the actors are essentially on the same page, that the tonality of their performances will blend together to make the movie work, to provide the proper tone and the proper feeling for it. So, yes, you supervise what the cameraman does, and you supervise the way the production is mounted, the way things go, but you work very closely with the actors to make sure that their performances are all of a piece and that they correspond to what you think is correct in relation to the script.
I heard a great description once of directing, directors being a filter, that you know, because you have a lot of contributors on a set. You have the actors, you have the cinematographer, the sound designer, all these things going on, but they all have to pass through you, and you're the one responsible for saying, well, this fits with my vision, this not so much. You know, so the director's filter is an idea
yeah,
I like a lot.
It's a good one. And also, the director is the person responsible to get everybody else involved in the movie or the television show to do their best possible creative work.
Yes, put down the donut and come back to work. Which reminds me of a Teamster joke that I'm not gonna share on the air because I like my tires filled with air.
Yeah.
What is your favorite part of the process? Is it working with actors, creating your shots, editing, collecting residuals?
I love it all. I truly love it all. But I think as the more I do it, the more I find working with actors, because nobody else on set, nobody else involved in the entire movie or show deals with the actors directly the way a director does. And I found that I've learned a lot over the years, and I love what actors can be. I love what actors can do, and I love finding ways to help them do it as well as they can.
Nice. I find casting very exciting because characters start coming to life. You see possibilities. And even if you don't cast somebody, I'm liable to steal ideas from people who come in.
Oh, yes. I've done that. That's terrible. Once or twice people have improvised little things in their casting sessions.
We're going to put that in the script.
In the script. You don't get the part.
All right. Well, I want to play a cut that you put into your very successful romantic comedy film, The Truth About Cats and Dogs, starring Uma Thurman and Janine Garofalo. That must have been fun. And we'll talk about it a little bit more afterwards. So this is The Bed's Too Big Without You by a band called The Police. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a lightning fast break for a few important messages. Be right back.
Download the SoCal Sound mobile app and listen wherever life takes you.
Support for the SoCal Sound comes from Live Nation, presenting the Bare Naked Ladies The Last Summer on Earth Tour with Guster and Fastball at the Greek Theater on June 22nd. Tickets for the Bare Naked Ladies are on sale now at Ticketmaster.com. The Bare Naked Ladies with Guster and Fastball, the Greek Theater, June 22nd.
It's been 1 week since you looked at me. Threw your arms in the air and said you're crazy. 5 days since you tackled me.
Support comes from Getzman Group, helping SoCal companies for more than 25 years in all areas of finance and accounting with professional staffing solutions. Information at GetzmanGroup.com, GetzmanGroup.com.
This is Public Music Radio in Southern California.
Playing music that's hand-selected by local DJs without any commercials. And we can't do it without you. When you become a station sponsor or program underwriter, you support the arts and help us launch new and local artists. As a business owner or individual, you can join us in building a stronger music community while building positive branding and awareness for your organization. Visit thesocalsound.org and click Become a Sponsor to learn more.
And thank you for supporting Public Music Radio.
Thanks.
This is Byron from the new bilingual sounds, the SoCal Sounds new HD channel. The country's first ever Latin alternative radio station just got rebranded. Search for bilingual sounds online, bilingualsounds.org, and in the App Store.
We're back. You're listening to The Soundtrack with our special guest director, Michael Lehman. Michael, are you having fun yet?
No, but I will be very shortly.
Okay. Well, let's get him another water. Okay. Listen, I want to ask you about how you like to use music to support comedy, or how not to use music to support comedy. Please spill.
That is a great question. Generally speaking, you use score to support comedy, mm-hmm. and it's very difficult because composers who don't have a really good sense of what the humor is mm-hmm. will try to hit the joke on the head.
Like a laugh track.
A laugh track or like a rim shot, that sort of thing, or the equivalent of that. And my feeling is generally you don't want to do that.
Unless you're doing vaudeville. Yeah.
Exactly. But people find ways to kind of subtly do that, and every once in a while it sort of works. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, I find when I get composed music to fit a comedy scene, I listen to it. I go, I don't know. I maybe play it for somebody and see if they laugh. Mm-hmm. And I end up taking it out. And quite often.
Entirely.
Sometimes entirely.
Okay.
And sometimes I find that music in comedy is great when it plays along and then it stops and lets the comedic scene play out.
Interesting.
So sometimes the lack of music becomes a musical element that underscores the comedy.
Very interesting. Yeah. I've had the experience in episodic television of putting a track against the comedic scene, and the track I put in was not trying to be funny. Like, I had one episode where the guy walks into a marijuana growing farm. This is back in the 90s, so it was not legal at the time. And I used reggae, and it was used for a lighthearted effect. And the producers, I won't say what show it was on, replaced the reggae track with this very on-the-nose pizzicato music that was telling you you're supposed to be like, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And the first time I saw it was airing, and I was so horrified, I just had to turn it off. I didn't watch it for about 6 months, because it just killed it. It was terrible.
It's the occupational hazard of being a television director,
that
where
is
you
true.
Don't make the final choices of music.
And yeah.
It's quite possible that somebody will take your carefully crafted, beautifully subtle and ironic use of music and
destroy
blow
it
out.
It does happen. Okay. Well, geez, I'm very jealous of this, but one of your early outings in television, maybe your first one, you got to work with one of my all-time favorite songwriters, Elvis Costello, and this was on The Larry Sanders Show, right?
Yeah.
So, well, before you tell us about working with Elvis, it's worth noting that The Larry Sanders Show was one of the first shows of the modern era, at least, that was a single-camera comedy. Can you help me explain why that was groundbreaking for its time?
Yeah. The typical television comedy is shot on a brightly lit stage with three cameras, and it's
or four,
played, three or four, right, played mostly live and cuts are made in a studio as you go along. And
they're all acting out towards an audience, so it's right. proscenium staging, like you're on a stage.
Yeah. As if you were watching it staged. And mm-hmm. then single camera implies it's shot like a movie, where mm-hmm. you have the camera in one spot, you do a shot, you finish it, you cut, you go to another spot, you shoot the various pieces separately.
Right.
And Sanders' show, for a comedy, at that time, it was early 90s, I guess.
Yeah.
It was unusual for a comedy to be shot that way. I don't know if
very unusual. Yes. I mean, somebody pointed out MASH to me, which was a single camera show
yes.
much earlier, a decade and a half earlier. But at the time that Larry Sanders came along, all comedies were multicams, like Friends, like Cheers, like Frasier.
Yeah.
And it was interesting. I broke in about a decade after you, mostly because I wasn't as good. But when I broke in, Malcolm in the Middle had just started, and that was a huge hit. And suddenly, and I had done this HBO show, Arliss, also single camera. So suddenly everybody wanted to do single camera, and I was one of like 40 persons who the studios thought could do comedy, because all the single camera people who knew how to make film were from the drama side, and the comedy people didn't know how to shoot like a movie.
Right. This is something I've run across before. I talk to people who do multicam. I don't understand how to do multicam. And
yeah.
I say, how do you do this stuff? And they yeah. go, how do you do that stuff?
Yeah.
There are very different skills involved on a technical level. The interesting thing about Sanders is that it was kind of a hybrid. We actually shot three 16-millimeter cameras simultaneously.
Okay.
Generally, the camera that led the actors through the workplace, through the radio station or the television station, they were shot with a cameraman who had a 16-millimeter camera on his shoulder and was wearing rollerblades. And he would rollerblade around with them, sometimes
okay.
being pulled backwards, sometimes so, going forwards.
Goodness.
Yes.
Early Steadicam.
Early yeah. Steadicam. And then other cameras would be hidden in the hutches of the set so that when the actors stopped –
yeah.
The other extra cameras would pick up the close-ups of what they were doing so that they could really perform it without breaking it into little pieces, and it helped
nice.
Give the show the rhythm that it had.
Oh, very, very interesting. So just cue up. We're going to play this Elvis Costello song. Tell us about the episode with Elvis.
Well, one of the episodes I happened to be doing, they told me, oh, you'll be so happy. We've got Elvis Costello coming on to be the guest. I
yeah.
said, oh, my God, I'm a huge fan. That's
yeah.
incredible. The story, I think, was that Janine Garofalo, who played the booker, the talent booker,
mm-hmm.
told everybody at the show, do not bother Elvis. Don't ask for an autograph.
Don't look him.
Don't look him in the eye, all that sort of thing. And then he comes. And nobody talks to him,
yeah.
and he trashes his dressing room.
Because he's so pissed off.
Yeah, God damn it, I came here, and nobody even talked to me.
That's great.
So when Elvis showed up, we had, I think, a total of maybe 2.5 hours, maybe less, to shoot all of his scenes and to shoot him perform a song. Because
wow.
he was going to play that night at the Universal Amphitheater.
Wow.
So I was told, you cannot take extra time. And I said, well, I don't know if this guy can act. What am I going to do? How are we going to do this? And he showed up. He was very, very friendly. And I said to him, I said, look, do you know the show? Because I had no idea. He goes, I've seen every episode. I said, oh, good. Do you know then that you're playing yourself. You do not have to act. You don't have to try to be
right.
any different than who you are. Yes, I totally get it.
Yeah.
I said, good, let's do it. And he did his scenes really well, very quickly. No problems. The other actors were in awe of him
yeah.
and had a great time. And then we went on to the part of the stage where they did their live Sanders show, which was lit differently and looked differently. And the band just went there and they played one and a little bit of another song.
Yes, we're going to play both of these songs. So the first song, we can explain it after the fact. This is the first song from Elvis Costello from his album Brutal Youth. This is 13 Steps Lead Down.
When nobody knows, she puts on secret clothes and lies in the meadow with her hands tied behind her back. I won't refuse if you know how to use it. Just stop playing that ugly drug. 13 steps lead down. 13 steps lead down. There's commoners and kings, and everyone's a prisoner. I'm never in you, and it's embarrassing.
seasons. Southern items will come to your head, because I just can't stand myself.
Talking to film and TV director Michael Lehman. I should explain, that wasn't a mistake on our fantastic engineer's part, Matt Blake. I told him to smash the songs together because the episode actually made fun of Elvis being banned from SNL for playing Radio Radio, where they were. He was told, you're not allowed to play that song because it impugned the good reputation of network radio. And he did it anyway, and Lorne Michaels said, that's it, you're banned from the show. Well, that lasted for about 5 years, and they had him back many times. But, Michael, you directed more episodes of the hit series True Blood than any other director. How's that for a segue? That was terrible.
Yeah.
15 in all, I think, 15 episodes. So did you have some kind of blackmail material on creator Alan Ball, or did he just love your work because you're so freaking talented?
Neither. but
I'm sure it was the latter.
Alan is terrific. He's really good. I actually tried and failed to get the job directing American Beauty, which he wrote a few years before that.
I
thought he didn't know who I was. I never directed any of 6 Feet Under.
Yeah.
And I went in for a meeting, I met with him, and we talked. It was in the first season of True Blood. They'd only made a couple of episodes. Mm-hmm. And I had a great meeting with Alan. I told him what I liked about the show, which was that it was satirical and funny and dark. And
dark.
Yeah, and we got on. And I had a blast making that show.
Well, he must have loved your first episode, because then you know he hired you back. I think you did 4 the first year and 4 the second year. You were like the guy, the tentpole guy.
Yeah, on some of these shows, as you know, they like to keep the same directors involved so that there's a sense of consistency
there. Yeah, it's a little easier on the actors not having to forge new relationships every time out.
Yeah, and that was a group of great actors. They were complicated. They were not difficult. They were lovely. Mm-hmm. But they expected to be directed by a director. They expected the directors to come in and know what they were doing. Yeah. And I had good chemistry with that cast.
Obviously. Yeah. That's great. Well, let's talk a little bit about directing episodic television. And you know more than anybody about this. You've had so many features and so many episodes. How is episodic different than directing features?
Well, it's different in many ways. And primarily, when you direct television, you're not using all the same skills that you would have to use when you direct a movie.
Okay.
You don't prep the same way. You mm-hmm. don't generally write the script. You don't do drafts of the script to mm-hmm. fit your vision.
Right.
You come in, you're hired. They say, this is the episode you're directing, and this is what we need from it.
And you don't know what script you're getting.
No.
You have no idea. The show. Yeah. Yeah.
You don't know what's going to be Elvis Costello or whatever.
Right.
So you are hired to be a director. Even if you're the producing director on the show, even if you're involved in the inception of the show, mm-hmm. to a certain degree, so I can stop talking about all this, as a director in television, you work
I don't want you to stop talking about it. You're here because I want you to talk about it.
You work for the writers.
Right.
You know, you can parse it any way you want, but at the end of the day, you work for the writers. And in movies, the writers work for you.
Yeah. Yeah, very different. And having heard you said that, my wife will definitely hire you back on her next show. Because, yep, he's got it right. No, yeah, that's very, very, very true. And, you know, I tell people, look, when I go on episodes, I'm not there to make a Lev L. Spiro film. I'm there to do the Melissa Rosenberg film or the, whoever the showrunner is, the Alan Ball film. And you try to push the envelope. I try to bring stuff to the table and, you know, insert my own brand of comedy or whatever it is. You're there to play in their sandbox.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, generally, I won't do a television show if I'm not completely on board for what it is.
Uh-huh.
And that way, I can get inside the head of the writers. I can understand what the show is meant to be.
Yeah.
And I can bring my own vision to it because I'm on board. It's harder when you're hired to direct a show that you don't really like.
In a completely mercenary sense, yes. Yeah. It is harder. I've noticed that.
It's not always mercenary, by the way. Sometimes it's a friend who says,
yeah,
will you come direct my show?
Right.
Or an actor that you love who says, I'd love for you to do this show that I'm doing.
Yeah.
And you come in and you don't necessarily love the show as much as you love your friend or the actor or whatever.
Or even on a good show, if you get a dog of a script, you know, that's like the writer's assistant wrote that one and then they all banged it in a room to try to get into shape. And it's like, oh, my God, how am I going to make this work?
Yeah. But in those cases, as a director, I go, great, here's a challenge. I've been given a subpar script and I'm going to do my best to make it the best episode of the season.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, very cool. Let's play a little taste of something from True Blood from one of your episodes, which was called Frenzy. This is the track Frenzy by Screamin' Jay Hawkins. Fuck.
gushes from my heart like water from a spout. You build a flame from a tiny spark. You can really knock me out. Yeah, he's my mind with your real cool line, daddy. Feel my soul with your love divine. When you say, man, oh my, I'm in a frenzy.
You have another producing credit, a smart, subversive comedy, which you also directed, The Woman in the House Across the Street from the Girl in the Window. I love that title. And this was really a passion project for you, right? Did you find the script, or how did this come about?
No, this was a case where I was called by the producers, who said they had a project that Kristen Bell was going to do, and that she had put me on the list of directors that she was interested in working with.
Oh, very nice.
So I love Kristen. I think she's terrific. I think she's hugely talented, and I really, really, really like working with her. And so I took the call, and I said, oh, yeah, if it's with her, I'm probably going to want to do this. Why don't you send me – I think at that point they only had an outline. And it was essentially a mock Woman in Jeopardy suspense thriller.
Right.
But with emphasis on mock, but it did not – it was not a parody. We did not make jokes. Mm-hmm. We just did a heightened version of it that was so ridiculous as that genre tends to
be. Could you say slightly satirical as opposed
slightly
to a parody?
Yeah. Yeah. And so I thought it was a great vehicle for her. So I took the meeting with the producers and told them how I would approach it and said I would go super dry on it.
I thought there was so much of you in that. We were friends by this time. And when I watched the show, I thought, oh, this is really Michael all over.
Oh, yeah,
he's got this very dry sense of irony underlaying everything else. So is there an added layer of joy with this sort of thing because it's something you're passionate about, or just an added layer of stress and disappointment?
No, joy and then followed by stress and
I want to play a Rolling Stones cut that you use for this show. Can you tell us how that came about? And did you have to like cut craft services for a week to afford it?
No, this was interesting. We were in post on the show. We were cutting it together, and we had a sequence that definitely lent itself to having a good song in there, and we could not find a good song. I don't remember exactly what we were playing around with, but nothing was working. And Hugh Davidson, who was one of the writers on the show, said, I have some ideas. Can I suggest them? And of course you can. And he brought up this Rolling Stones song, which is a song that I love.
My favorite album by them.
Yeah, it's a great song. And I said, Hugh, we're not going to be able to afford that.
Yeah.
We'll never be able to put that in. We probably can't even get the rights to that.
Yeah.
So, you know, wishful thinking, fine. But, you know, I don't know what cloud you're living on. And
Somehow it happened. Wow. Well, let's take a little listen to this. This is a song called Can't You Hear Me Knocking by the Rolling Stones.
Yeah!
Michael, what's the most joyful part of being a director for you? What do you love most about the job?
Well, I'm going to go anti-Sartre on this and say, hell is not other people. I love working with other people.
Ah, nice.
That's what the part of directing that I really, truly enjoy is that you have a group of people around you and you work creatively together.
A group of very creative people who are giving you ideas. And I always encourage people by saying, you know, please give me your best ideas. I will take credit for them. That's what I do. But it's a group process. That's my encouragement. We are sadly out of time for tonight. I want to thank our most excellent guest, Mr. Michael Lehman, for giving us his time tonight and talking about all things music and film. Thank you, Michael. I told you it would be more fun than orthodonture. Did I lie?
I kind of like getting my teeth straightened, but
okay, well then, all things are relative. Folks, join me next time on The Soundtrack when we talk to composer, songwriter, lead guitarist, and producer Tyler Bates. Tyler has composed the scores for some small, not very well-known films like Guardians of the Galaxy, John Wick 1, 2, 3, and 4, Deadpool, Fast and Furious, little indies like those, you know, Michael. And in his spare time, he's the touring music director, lead guitarist, and producer for Marilyn Manson. He's also just a fascinating and generous guy. So tune in. Thanks again, Michael, for coming in tonight. We're going to leave you with a track featured in a series that you've been working on for the last year. It's Dexter Original Sin.
The origin story of Dexter.
The origin story. Fantastic. And you did a bunch of the original series as well, yes?
I did that. Yeah.
Amazing. Okay. Well, guys, thanks so much for listening to The Soundtrack tonight. This is Susie and the Banshees. Kiss Them for Me.